sich was kann mir das Leben Schub geben. Er ist Speed und Kastanena, der lebt gleich wie eine Feder. Das wahre Leben, wo die Geister schweben, ist für Hermann liebenswert. Da muss ich nicht verkehrt. Er sagt sich, so kommt jeder Hirn nie auf Touren. Er fühlt sich weise und erleuchtet, wenn er zartlich seine Zunge mit Schmerz befeuchtet. Das wahre Leben, wo die Geister spielen, hat Wärmann seinen Sinn. Was für ihn nicht hin? Abgehoben, abgefahren. Hermann, wo bist du?
Ei, 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 ei.
Abgetrieben, abgetrieben. Hermann, wo bist du? Hermann ist hart. Er sagt sich, scheiße, das doch aber ja. Mit negativen Vibrationen konnte ich Hermann bisher verschonen. Das wahre Leben kann ich einfach so erleben. Er braucht die Spritzen und die Pillen, um sich überhaupt noch mit zu füllen. Ah, ah, ah. Da, die Wand kippt um. Ja Gott, und die Decke kommt runter. Und der Teppich. Und immer tiefer und immer tiefer in die Worten ein Happy Takeness.
Mama! Papa!
Open Marken! Polizei! Abgehoben, abgefahren. Hermann, wo bist du? Ey, 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 weggetreten, abgetreten. Hermann, wo bist du? Hermann ist hart!
Spies Are Us, a history of the CIA, presented by Tom Mangold. Program 1, The Focus of Evil.
The toughest question to ask an intelligence is, what do they think? It's relatively easy to count the missiles and the bombs and the tanks and so forth. Well, it's not easy, it's expensive, it's complicated, but you can do it. But to try and get a sense of what do they really think, what do they know, that's difficult.
What do they think? What do they know? Herb Mayer, former special assistant to the director of Central Intelligence, defining the jewels of intelligence acquisition. Defining it as one thing, implementing as another. Especially when the CIA's principal target was the almost impregnable Soviet Union. By the 1980s, that failure to find out what the Kremlin was actually thinking very nearly made the Cold War hot. How did messages and perceptions between the superpowers become so distorted? Why was the intelligence take so bad? That's what I'll be looking at in this first part of my series on key moments in the CIA's history, a history that began with its birth in 1947 on a presidential directive from Harry Truman. Mel Goodman, who was to serve the agency for 20 years as a senior Soviet analyst.
The CIA was formed to do intelligence analysis and intelligence research. The covert action capability was given to the CIA in 1952, 5 years later, and it was over the protests of many high-ranking CIA officials who felt the major mission and the mission that President Harry Truman wanted to pursue was one objective branch of government, not part of the policy process, that would give intelligence analysis and assessments to the president, to the administration, that would not be grinding a policy axe. It would have no policy interest or parochialism or spin whatsoever.
And the target?
The target was the Soviet Union. This was the beginning of the Cold War, but the origins of the CIA would be Pearl Harbor.
The national trauma of Pearl Harbor and the surprise Japanese attack on the U.S. Navy's fleet was the event that ultimately led to Truman's creation of the CIA, a civilian central intelligence agency empowered to make sure that America would never again be caught unawares. It would snoop around the world and warn its major client, the president in the White House here in Washington, of all likely threats to America's national security. Now, top of that threat list was Stalin's Soviet Union. One of the agency's first operations was to counter Soviet political expansion into Western Europe. Greece was threatened, so was Italy, where in 1948 the communists stood a chance of winning national elections. Intelligence officers working with Secretary of State George Marshall, whom Truman had put in charge of American reconstruction in Europe, knew what he wanted done.
General Marshall was a four-star general, and his thought about the Russians was just something horrid, you know. And he pushed us all to come up with ideas. Go to that little newspaper and have them publish the damn thing. And we've got to get this country rolling, and the only thing is, we defeat the communists.
Mark Wyatt, later CIA station chief in Rome, remembers the scene on the evening of the election.
I was invited to the Hassler Hotel overlooking all of Rome, and General Marshall was there. Champagne was poured, and there were a whole group of satchels that had money in them, obviously. And the satchels varied in size depending upon the party. 8-9 million at that time was a lot of money. And the reports that they had received from how hard that party was working against the communists.
Italy was the CIA's first real success and showed the value of knowing the territory, having local networks, and a generous supply of slush fund dollars. The problem for the CIA was that it was unable to repeat this where it mattered most, inside the Soviet Union. With virtually no networks on the ground, it was reduced to debriefing travelers returning from business in Russia, people whose intelligence value was often minimal. There were times in the early 50s when the agency didn't even know the price of potatoes in Moscow. Hardly surprising, then, that there were similar intelligence failures at the highest level. The launch of Sputnik, the world's first ever satellite, came as a total and deeply unwelcome shock in Washington. So the CIA turned to that invariable American fallback, technological superiority. As Dick Kerr, number two at the agency in the late 80s and early 90s, recalls, the age of the mechanical spook was born.
Our major problem was the nature of the Soviet strategic capability. What military forces did they have? How were they going to use them? How were they changing and modernizing their military? And those are the very things that one can monitor most easily with technical intelligence, with imagery, overhead imagery, and signals intelligence, and all the other technical means.
But technological prowess doesn't fulfill Herb Meyer's dictum, what do they think, what do they know, as the Soviets realized only too well.
With the help of the signal intelligence, you can establish how many missiles are on the enemy's territories and their combat readiness, but only by penetrating the human's mind, you can learn if these missiles are going to be launched, and if yes, when. So, in the KGB, they believe that there is no substitute for the human intelligence.
Yuri Shvets, a sharp young agent of the KGB's Washington Bureau, or residency, in the 1980s. There's no doubt that Soviet spy rings were demonstrably successful in the West. The Portland Ring, led by the infamous Krogers, spied on Britain's submarine base on the south coast. The Rosenbergs in America stole atomic secrets for their KGB masters in Moscow. A serious problem, one of which the CIA was unaware until it was far too late, was the paranoid character of James Jesus Angleton, its legendary head of counterintelligence. He became convinced, quite wrongly, that virtually every Soviet defector to the West was a double agent deliberately dispatched by the KGB to deceive. So time and again, the intelligence take from these vital sources was discounted and ignored. This, in turn, left the CIA over-reliant on its technology. The policymakers in Washington also needed to know what were the Soviets' intentions. One way to find out was to investigate and analyze the Soviet Union's economy. Many answers would flow from that.
I think you start with a long heritage of misunderstanding and overestimating the size and efficiency of the Soviet economy.
In other words, even that task was beyond the intelligence gatherers and analysts in CIA headquarters at Langley, just outside Washington. Arnold Horlick ought to know. Part of his career was spent as the leading CIA expert on the Soviet economy.
This was a function, perhaps, of being bedazzled by the military output of the Soviet economy, which for many years was keeping up pretty much with our own, and a few areas even doing better. But this was on the basis of an economy that was a generation behind our own. And the methodology that was employed by the agency to compare the economies, the so-called dollar-ruble conversions, in retrospect were very misleading. So, for example, the notion that the Soviet economy was half as large as ours, or going toward two-thirds as large as ours, I think was grossly wrong in real touch-it, see-it, feel-it terms. But in terms of the methodology that was employed, it sounded sensible.
But it was the wrong call, one which had profound political consequences. Richard Perle, later Assistant Secretary of Defense under President Reagan, and a key client of the CIA's analytical conclusions.
The CIA, by virtue of its underestimation of the burden on the Soviet economy of the sustained weapons buildup that was then underway, misled policymakers who were at the negotiating table. That is to say, they created a sense that if we didn't reach agreements limiting weaponry, there would be a surge in Soviet production, and we would find that they were even stronger. In fact, they were working at the maximum they could sustain, and couldn't sustain much longer.
As doubts about the accuracy and value of their intelligence were raised by the CIA's various high-powered customers, the agency was forced to solicit and listen to advice from outside its Langley headquarters. That came from a group of critical experts called Team B, people who believed that the CIA was misinterpreting data from the Soviets. This error they attributed to the agency's assumption that Soviet institutions were mirror images of their American counterparts. The CIA's own team was Team A. Dick Kerr.
There was a sense that CIA was not addressing the information it had in an objective way, that it had predetermined notions about what the outcome of its analysis should be. So a group of outsiders, which were Team B, were brought in to take another and supposedly an independent look at that information and come to its judgment. The A-team, B-team kind of concept is a valid concept. It's to bring alternative judgments to bear on complex problems. The difficulty with the A-team, B-team exercise in this case was that it was already predetermined that the B-team was going to disagree fundamentally with the other opinion.
They were more hawkish.
They were hawkish, and they were coming in to describe that more dire and pessimistic picture.
The more hawkish Team B had uncovered institutional weaknesses. For all the CIA's technology, brain power, and money, insiders knew it wasn't making the right calls, and sometimes no calls at all, about the momentous events that were happening in the real world outside. Mel Goodman.
In the analytical area of the CIA, they were surprised by Czechoslovakia in 1968. They were wrong about Hungary in 1956. They were somewhat ambivalent even about Afghanistan. And President Carter claims to this day that he was never given advance warning about the Soviet entry into Afghanistan in December of 1979. So I think the analytical component was probably too sanguine about what Soviet military intentions were.
I, Ronald Reagan, do solemnly swear
that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
That I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
Ronald Reagan being sworn into the presidency in 1981 here on the steps of the Capitol. And with his arrival, the worldview in Washington changed. Containment of the Soviet Union was out, and confrontation of the empire of evil was in.
Before Reagan, virtually every leader of every party had the same objective, which was to not lose the Cold War.
Herb Mayer was special assistant to the new CIA chief.
President Reagan came in with a very different objective. He said, I want to win. Because he had a different objective, he was open to a different form of intelligence. If your objective is to win, then you look for your adversary's vulnerability. If your objective is to not lose, you tend to be more focused on your enemy's strengths because you're only playing defense. So President Reagan shifted us from defense to offense. That was an enormous difference.
It was unmistakable. Defense spending in the West soared. Cruz and Pershing II missiles were deployed in Western Europe. The American Air Force and Navy stepped up spying and probing operations right at the edge of Soviet borders. The CIA, under the new leadership of the irascible old Cold Warrior Bill Casey, launched an aggressive operation to force the Soviet adventure in Afghanistan onto the defensive. Within the Soviet Empire, Poland's Solidarity Trade Union received special CIA donations and equipment. The superpower balance began to tilt. So how did the aging Soviet leadership react, now under Yuri Andropov, former head of the KGB? Oleg Kalugin, a former KGB general himself, currently enjoying capitalist business adventures in his old target city of Washington.
One day we received a cable from Moscow, urgent, signed by Andropov. And in effect it said that at no time after World War II, the Soviet Union and the West were closer to another war. And for that reason, he said, because of the United States government and its Western allies now preparing for a major military or aggressive act, which was not specified, we must be fully mobilized, and the intelligence and counterintelligence services and all the military now on full alert.
But Andropov was a sensible man, former head of the KGB, now first secretary. You must have been stunned when you got that. You must have thought, what on earth is going on?
It was truly based on fear. The Soviet Union at the time was slowly degenerating. So this kind of a hysteria was a reflection of the Soviet assessment of the Western potential and our lack of that ability to follow and compete with them.
And it got worse for Moscow. By the spring of 1983, President Reagan was telling Americans,
"What if free people could live secure in the knowledge that their security did not rest upon the threat of instant U.S. retaliation to deter a Soviet attack, that we could intercept and destroy strategic ballistic missiles before they reached our own soil or that of our allies?"
The Strategic Defense Initiative, dubbed Star Wars, was a trillion-dollar plan to make the U.S. invulnerable to a nuclear attack. This plan, seen from Moscow, seemed to spell the end of the policy of nuclear deterrence which had maintained a balance of terror and peace for over 30 years. Furthermore, it was a system the Soviets could match with neither technology nor hard cash. They began to panic. Arms talks with the Americans were abandoned. And then,
"While they preach the supremacy of the state, declare its omnipotence over individual man, and predict its eventual domination of all peoples on the earth, they are the focus of evil in the modern world."
The temperature of the Cold War dropped below freezing. And then,
"Washington has accused the Soviet Union of shooting down the South Korean airliner which disappeared overnight off northern Japan. The State Department says the Boeing 747 was brought down with a missile and a Russian pilot..."
The U.S. reaction from Ambassador to the UN Jean Kirkpatrick was calculated and revealing.
"Quite simply, the Soviets decided to shoot down a civilian airliner, shot it down, murdering the 269 persons on board, and lied about it."
Now began a remarkable period in Soviet post-war history, a moment completely missed or misread by the CIA. Convinced by all these events that the Americans were preparing for war, the Soviets in turn launched Operation Rhiann to look for signs that the West was about to launch a nuclear first strike. This is how an increasingly paranoid Soviet leadership briefed its KGB spies at the Washington Residency. Yuri Shvets.
"There were guys in our residency whose job was every night to drive around. One guy was driving around Pentagon, another guy was driving around the State Department, the White House, etc., the key government institution, and to watch how many lights are on, if there are too many lights, unusually many lights. That was supposed to be a signal. I remember one day we received a circular cable from Moscow, meaning that it went out to all major stations, saying, 'Look, guys, this is how you should work on Brian.' And they quote this particular episode when the London station reported to Center that the British government announced a recruitment of donors to donate blood. So the station reported to Moscow that we believe this is a part of the preparation of the British government for the nuclear war, a part of Brian program. And the head of the service, Khrushchev, said, they knew that they would be preparing for this kind of war. And this is the proof. So this is a vicious circle."
So perfectly ordinary activities like seeking new blood donors suddenly assumed the most menacing interpretations. The FBI, who shadowed the known KGB officers, was baffled by this new and seemingly pointless touring of Washington by night, such as here at the Pentagon. And then in November 1983, a military exercise called Able Archer, unfortunately timed, took NATO forces through the full-scale simulated release of nuclear weapons. Seen from Moscow, the dots were now joining up, suggesting the nightmare of war. But what really lay behind this perception?
The paranoia was by itself pretty much dangerous, because any margin of error of assessment of this paranoia by itself could lead to a disaster. Had the Soviet leadership during the time of Cuban Missile Crisis had the same kind of paranoia they had in the 80s, I believe the outcome of the missile crisis in 62 could have been absolutely different.
So do you believe that the CIA should have programmed into its analysis the extent of Soviet paranoia in the 80s?
I don't think they understood that.
But the British did have an idea of what was happening, thanks to a very high-level defector in place recruited by MI6 in Copenhagen. Colonel Oleg Gordievsky, who rose to number 3 at the London residency, knew exactly what the Kremlin leadership was doing and thinking. Through his British handlers, the Americans were tipped off. Even then, as top CIA Soviet analyst Fritz Ehrmacht now recalls, the agency still didn't get it right.
We posed ourselves this question. Are they gearing up for some military initiative that they know carries the risk of war and are therefore preparing for it? Or are they acting out of fear that we are gearing up for some sort of a challenge that could lead to war? And they need to preempt that, at least in a defensive sense. And we came to the conclusion, no, they're not doing either. They are not doing what the cookbook, you know, how the Warsaw Pact forces were supposed to behave in peacetime and supposed to behave as they prepared for war. They're not doing what the cookbook calls for them to do, and they would be doing it if they were genuinely fearful that their own actions or our actions would provoke a war.
No intelligence cookbook could give the right recipe for dealing with an irrational outbreak of paranoia in the Soviet Union. Oleg Gordievsky, the British KGB asset whose work for Western intelligence was to earn him a personal invitation to visit President Reagan, was struck by the persistence of outmoded thinking at CIA headquarters.
When I started to visit the CIA, beginning of 86, and we discussed the Soviet strategy and the nuclear armaments and so on, they were still not persuaded I was right about all what I was saying, about paranoia and about the belief that the United States would suffer a nuclear attack. And one important analyst told me it was a huge deception plan by the Soviet leadership to deceive us. So they were so deeply rooted in their own dogmas of the previous time, when they received fresh and different information which clashed with their dogmas, they didn't like it. They were not flexible enough.
But they did finally get the message, and the war scare ended with messages of reassurance sent through traditional back-channel communications between Washington and Moscow. Now the biggest political tsunami since World War II was about to erupt. And where was the CIA? Mel Goodman, the agency's seasoned Kremlinologist.
The proudest achievement at the CIA in my 20 years was, yes, I was out in front in recognizing that Mikhail Gorbachev was different, that he was conducting a strategic revolution, that Edward Shevardnadze was a foreign minister like no other. It's a very sad aspect because a lot of this was reporting I could never get out of the CIA building because it was stopped for political reasons.
So you are writing memoranda to whoever saying there's something different happening here, there's something quite cataclysmic in a way going on in the Soviet Union. Gorbachev is not out of the same style, out of the same mold. And these memoranda were being blocked.
When you think about it, the central question of our time, all of us in our generation, was Soviet policy changing and was Gorbachev for real? And on those key questions, the key questions of our time, upper management of the CIA was wrong and the small group of us had it right.
And Dick Kerr, reflecting a problem that has endured to this day at the agency, believes the CIA consistently focused on the close-up and ignored the bigger picture.
We get enamored with individuals and sometimes forget that the institutions and the people surrounding those individuals are more important, because we like to deal with a person better than we like to assess an institution as such.
In not making the correct assessments of Soviet institutions, the CIA inevitably failed in one of its key tasks, the correct interpretation of the superpower's military strength and efficiency, a prime intelligence target. The annual Moscow May Day parades of military might were deceptive. Then a unique opportunity for the CIA to see for itself occurred, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. Milt Bearden, the tough CIA station chief, personally organized Mujahideen opposition to the invasion. He crossed the border many times. What he saw for himself weren't the triumphs of the much-touted and highly geared Soviet military machine. He saw an army that couldn't even defeat mountain men with flintlocks and old sandals.
I don't think anything that CIA could have said which would have sounded as follows. By the way, you know, the Soviet Union is really just
fairly above third world level, Mr. President. You don't have to spend all this money that you're spending to prepare to engage them. Who's going to do that? Nobody did that.
Even though it was the truth?
I'm not sure people believed it was the truth. And the reason I tell you that is because when I started sending dispatches from Afghanistan saying, you know, in many ways the army that I seem to be lined up against over here, the much-vaunted Soviet army, looks pretty third world to me. Almost nothing works. So I'm sending this stuff back. And I'm getting, you know, from the Soviet analytical side of the house, and ding, like, who does he think he is?
Is it that they didn't really want to hear that news?
I don't think they believed it.
They didn't believe it. Of course, even Gorbachev had misjudged the power of the changes he'd unleashed, but then he wasn't running the CIA. Those who were simply couldn't imagine that after half a century of eyeball-to-eyeball confrontation, the Soviets would blink and retreat into history without firing a shot at the West. Ditko, with hindsight, half forgives that failure.
What we did not understand, nor did I think Gorbachev understand, was the impact of this political change would have on the Soviet Union. The fact that Gorbachev would actually take steps to destroy the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. And the implications of that political change, I don't think we saw them in advance.
It wasn't so much a failure of intelligence collection and analysis as a failure of imagination.
I think that's probably a fair comment, although early on, if we would have, say in the mid-80s, we would have said the Soviet Union was in the process of breaking up. I think people in the administration and elsewhere, with some cause, would have said, you have flights of imagination.
What do they think? What do they know? There's no getting away from Herb Meyer's dictum. The lack of sound human intelligence sources, human, has dogged the CIA throughout its history. Ultimately, the agency failed in a definitive test of thinking itself into the mind of its target and anticipating events. And there was a corollary. The obsession with the communist threat over so many years distorted its intelligence gathering elsewhere in the world with profoundly damaging consequences. That's what I'll be examining in the next program.
Spies Are Us, a history of the CIA, was presented by Tom Mangold. The editor is Maria Belinska. Spies Are Us, a history of the CIA. Presented by Tom Mangold. Program 2, Losing Friends and Influencing No One.
Vietnam is a clear example that the intelligence can be spot on, but if the policymakers are not reading it or not paying attention to it, it doesn't matter what frequency the intelligence community is on.
In Iran, the CIA were not a neutral observer. And they had something at stake. And the stake was their relationship with the Shah and his regime that was extremely important to them. They simply were not prepared to sit back and look at it objectively.
Vietnam and Iran, two examples of how the CIA lost the intelligence game despite being right in the first case and plain wrong in the second. In Vietnam, the CIA's customers at home just didn't want to hear what the agency was saying. In Iran, the CIA was too myopic to see the truth, with profound consequences for America's understanding of Islamic fundamentalism. In this week's program in my series on CIA history, I'm going to show just how and why these errors occurred, and why these failures still stalk Washington's policymakers to this day. We begin with America's disastrous involvement in Vietnam, famously described in fiction by Graham Greene.
We've got to contain communism, or what they call communism.
What could be done, what should be done, what he thought, what he'd read. He made me remember there was a time when I had wanted to make a difference.
What is it? To watch liberty snuffed out?
Liberty is a very Western word. How do you define it for the Vietnamese?
by giving people the freedom to choose.
Okay, you give them the freedom to choose, they vote and they elect Ho Chi Minh. Things are more complicated than they seem.
The conventional view of the CIA in Saigon. Quiet Americans, naive, blundering, bamboozled. But Graham Greene's judgment was far too harsh. What he didn't know at the time was that whenever the CIA was right in its assessments, it was cold-shouldered by its political masters at home.
The worst thing you can do with intelligence, from my perspective at least, is to be ignored by your policymakers.
Dick Kerr, former Deputy Director of Central Intelligence. His career at CIA goes back to 1960, as the communists in North Vietnam began to fight to reunite the North with the Catholic capitalist South.
There is on a regular basis information that in effect says to the president, if he's sensitive, your policy's not working. Intelligence is saying we're assessing what's happening on the ground, the object of your policy, and it's not happening the right way. In fact, it may be doing exactly opposite of what you want.
Would the best example of this be Vietnam, where the agency, one is told, consistently warned the president that this war would go on much longer than he wanted it to go on, that it was unwinnable in the short term, that mistakes were being made? Is that a good example of what you're saying?
It is. It's probably the most unfortunate example of a disconnect between the policy and the intelligence assessing the implications and the actions as a result of that policy.
By the 1960s, there had indeed been a loss of synchronization between the decision makers in government and the CIA. Washington believed that if Vietnam fell to the communists, so would the whole region. Remember the domino theory?
The loss of Vietnam would trigger the loss of Southeast Asia and conceivably even the loss of India, and would strengthen the Chinese and the Soviet position across the world.
Robert McNamara, Kennedy's and Johnson's Secretary of Defense, the administration's hard man on foreign policy. Now, the domino theory was a seductive philosophy here in Washington. It was one that kept the Pentagon budgets flowing and squared with the conventional wisdom of Soviet attempts at world domination.
When I was training in the agency to go to Vietnam, I was hit over the head with the domino theory. I was told it was what would define the future of South Vietnam. The ideology that propelled us into the war obscured history. And it was obviously a terrible oversight, because in embracing the domino theory, we perpetuated our presence there. We justified staying in.
Frank Snepp was principal analyst for the CIA on North Vietnam from the late 60s. The CIA realized that the domino theory was seriously flawed. The agency understood that the presentation of the Vietnamese as communists, pure and simple, was superficial and wrong. Ray McGovern was its top specialist on the international communist movement.
They were Marxists through and through, but nationalists first, I would say. And there's a big difference. In other words, if there were traditional Marxists, as we looked at the, quote, international communist movement in those days, they would be subservient to, or at least susceptible to, influence from Moscow and from Beijing. These fellows were independent.
The truth is that in Vietnam, the CIA had good human intelligence sources, ran productive networks, and worked well with the U.S. special forces behind enemy lines. But its intelligence take on the number of communist troops on the ground and their state of weaponry flew in the face of inflated Pentagon claims. The CIA also disproved alarming assertions that the North Vietnamese were receiving massive support from communist China and the Soviet Union. General Brent Scowcroft, later national security advisor to two presidents at the White House, spent much time on Vietnam while based at the Pentagon in the early 70s. And recalls the damage done to American policy by the disconnect between CIA and Pentagon.
Well, there was a great deal of unrealism about Vietnam. In the first place, we were never crystal clear about what our objectives were, what would constitute success, and what would be required to achieve success, and the intelligence estimates played into all that. And my recollection is you're right, that in retrospect, the agency proved to be fairly accurate in its assessment of supplies coming in.